Well, the biblical text is, those that endure to the end shall be saved. So that's, you've done a great job to endure to the end. So well done, everybody. Again, I want, if I may, to go through this by looking at the context. The context is that in the United Kingdom, you have to make a choice now. You make a choice because you're either a research university or a teaching university. And the funding from central government is going to be different according to which kind of institution you are. So there's an enormous pressure to do research. Now, the word research covers a multitude of sins. If you do a book, that's a piece of research. If you get a grant, that's a piece of research. If you do a broadcast on radio or television, that's a piece of research. I have invitations from about 4 or 5 different academic institutions in the UK to become a member of their faculty, honorary. And I think I write them why? So that they can use my broadcasts in the research exercise, because every broadcast counts as a book. So I was doing 2 or 3 broadcasts a week. So imagine how productive a writer I was in theory. Now, that shows the problem with a system which says, this is the way we're going to divide everything up, and your institution will have to conform. And so institutions are looking for ways round the system. There's also, of course, pressure for tenure. I have a friend who's an Old Testament scholar, a guy called David Clines, and he came to the States. And the trouble with being a visiting speaker is you run out of things to speak at. And so he was on a university campus and didn't have anywhere to speak. So he went to the library. And he thought, what will I do in the library? Well, I don't want to read a book, but I'll look at the journals. So he went to the journals and he thought, I wonder if they have anything in Old Testament. So he found a journal. He didn't know this journal, never seen it before, never heard of it. He picked it up and he scanned the contents. And he said, that looks like a really interesting article. And so he read it and he thought, this is familiar. And he read it a bit more. And he said, this is very familiar. And he read it a bit more and he said, I wrote this. And so he looked at the end and it was so-and-so, State University. So he phones up the guy and he says, that's my article. And the guy says, I know. He says, well, what's this about? He said, I was coming up for tenure and I didn't have time to write anything new. So I looked for an obscure article that was really good. And I thought, you know, this will give it a wider public. Yeah, but it was under your name rather than my name. So the person didn't get tenure. And David Clines, I think he was pleased that his article was read, but he wasn't pleased the other way it was done. Now imagine what that does to the system. If a piece of research is not your own piece of research, if we cannot rely on what's in publication, that it actually comes from the person who makes the claim. I was in conversation with somebody the other day about medical articles. And of course, medical articles usually have about 25 people who wrote them. And so the question is not who's number 24, it's who's number one. And of course, if you're head of department, your name automatically appears. In the UK, every article that you write, your head of department has to appear on the list. Now, what does that actually mean? Does that mean that you actually read it or took part in it or were involved in the research or not? So the pressure in academic institutions in the US, tenure is an odd kind of thing in the American system. It's odd in the British system as well. But to get tenure in a place like Wheaton, for example, you have to show that you do research, you do writing, but you also have to show you are involved in the institution. You know, it's like Mae West saying, marriage is a wonderful institution, but I'm not ready for an institution yet. Well, what does institutional involvement mean? But you also got to be involved in the community. What does involvement in the community mean? And I've got, you know, young faculty friends who are totally exhausted. They're totally exhausted because they're trying to do their teaching and prepare their teaching. They're trying to get some research going, but they have to be involved institutionally and they have to be involved in the community. And, you know, they're only 24 hours in the day and 7 days in the week. The demands for research are huge. Many of my senior academic medical colleagues do not actually practice medicine now. They don't actually practice research now. What they practice is grant writing. They spend their life raising money, because once upon a time the funding was hard money. You could guarantee this money would be there for 5 to 10 years. Now the money is often on a 1 or 2 year cycle. And so they no sooner got a grant than they have to start writing the next grant to make sure that the people who are part of the team will have employment. And so the talent, the research talent, is actually often being wasted. I think I want to suggest that one of the tensions for people in research, and this is true particularly in arts and humanities, is do we do research for the sake of research? Or do we do research because it's something which is important, something which is relevant, something which will make a difference? And that's a tension that people often feel. There are all kinds of questions which are really interesting. When I was in Arizona State, they said if I wanted an honours degree, I had to write a dissertation, a thesis. I said, well, what am I supposed to do? He said, choose a topic and write it. So I chose a topic. You know, I talked about idealism. I knew a little bit about idealism. I said, philosophical idealism in light of Plato. That was my topic. And so I did the research. I wrote up the piece. And I thought it was very interesting. You know, and they had a little defense, a little viva, where two of the faculty quizzed me about this piece of work. And at the end of, you know, 40 minutes, they said, well, congratulations, you've passed. Of course, there isn't anything in this, you know, it doesn't really make sense, but you've passed. I've spent weeks writing this thing. And so why was I doing the research? I was doing the piece of research because it meant you got the honors bit. You know, you didn't just get the BA, you got the BA summa cum laude. And so that made it all worthwhile. But did it? What's the point, the purpose? And, you know, with PhD students, I have PhD students who do PhDs because they need to be qualified to do what they really want to do. They're not really interested in the PhD. They're interested in doing what they really want to do. There are others who are actually fascinated by the subject area. And that becomes the life. I have a student who was interested in prostitution in Birmingham. And she became embedded in a community of women prostitutes. And that's become her life's work. It was an academic piece of work. It was a very good piece of work. But she was so built into relationships with these women and their stories and what was happening that now that's her whole life. She didn't go into academia. She ended up as part of that community, not acting as a prostitute, but acting as an advisor, a guide, a friend, because the research was something that affected her personally. We mentioned this morning the Miss America question and the way in which she responded about whether or not she approved of gay marriage, and, you know, this comment about, well, I think marriage is, you know, in my family, it was interesting the way she actually introduced it. My family, you know, we think that marriage is between a man and a woman, which was a perfectly sad. But of course, the judge who'd asked the question was not happy with the answer. Now, was this a neutral question? No way. Of course, it was a question which carried a particular set of values which he offended. And therefore, allegedly, we don't know whether it's actually the case, but allegedly, that meant that she lost the title. Because there is no neutrality. Everybody is coming from a particular perspective. And the trick is to spot the perspective. We need actually to learn real wisdom in understanding what are people assuming. What are they assuming about human nature? What are they assuming about the world? What are they assuming about what is good? And what are in the best interests of people? We need actually to think very carefully about the myth of neutrality. But research needs to be controlled. That's why we have some kind of limits. If you come to visit Oxford, I will take you to see the best guarded building in the university. It is the Animal House. The Animal House is the most secure. There are two police cars which circle the Animal House 24 hours a day. It's like a concentration camp. If you work in the animal lab, you do not drive your car because it would be too dangerous, because people are taking photographs of every car that goes into the car park so they recognise the number and they will deliver a letter bomb through your door when they find out where you are. Animals are hugely protected because they're very concerned. For a while, you could do experiments on human beings, you could do experiments on embryos, no restriction. But you couldn't use animals because they were very tightly controlled and they had inspectors. I had a PhD student who was working with one chimpanzee. He was about 2.5 years through, he was just about at the writing up stage, and somebody else in the animal house mistreated an animal. They closed the whole animal house, they killed all the animals, and his thesis disappeared down the plug hole. That's how strict the regime, the limiting of research was. IRBs, and in Oxford we have a central Oxford Research Ethics Committee, asked the question, why do we have a committee? Why do committees have to decide about what research should be done, shouldn't be done? And the answer was, well, because when people began doing research, I was telling the bioethics group, when people began research, they had a very simple test. Would the researcher do it to himself or herself? And then they discovered that some researchers will do anything to themselves for the sake of their theory. So they said, well, that's all good enough. Well, would they do it to a member of their family? And then they discovered that some researchers will do anything to their family for the sake of the theory. So that's why they began to have research ethics committees, IRBs, to make sure there were some kind of objective known standards that could be applied. Of course, the law becomes. It's interesting to me that in the UK we have gone down the legal route. We said we cannot leave it up to the morality of individual researchers or individual institutions. So we need to pass a law, fertility treatment. Should we control what happens in fertility? I gave a presentation to a group in Wheaton about how Optimum fulfilled the divine command. Be fruitful and multiply. And boy, did she take this seriously. So they should all rejoice in Optimum. For some reason, they didn't like that idea, but they didn't know why they didn't like the idea. You see, now that was my concern. I was trying to provoke them into thinking, if you say this is wrong, why? Why is it wrong? And if you were arguing with people who, and everybody was interested in Optimum, they still are, they're fascinated. What do you say to them? How do you begin the conversation? How do you begin to unpack the values there? Well, Britain decided the law needed to control. So we have very, very strict rules about fertility clinics. We have very strict rules about transplantation. There was a guy, Turkey, very ordinary Turkish peasant, and he was given a free trip to London. He was put up in a wonderful hotel. They even gave him something to help him sleep. And when he woke up, he had a slight pain, and there was a little scar there, and they gave him, like almost $1,000. And flew him back to Turkey. And now that unit is closed down because his kidney was removed without his consent. Because a rich Arab needed a good match and they found the match in Turkey. And so they were taking advantage of it. Now the law forbids that. And so the law closed down the institution. Everybody's made unemployed immediately. Just because they broke the law. Not because just of morality. But there is a sense in which people have consciences. I am impressed, I have to say, with the level of awareness that many professional groups have about their practice. They are concerned that the public are convinced. Now, this is interesting to me. Do you do something because it's right and good, or do you do something because you want the public to think it's right and good? And the two have become merged for many professional groups. And so they do what's right and good, not necessarily because they think this is right and good, because they want to make sure that the public perception, the public media presentation, will be positive about what they do. And so they have people who spend their lives writing press releases in order to show this is a good thing, and this is a worthwhile thing, and this will actually make a difference. All of us have values. And I think as Christians we need to be a little bolder in pointing out that people who don't share our faith, they have values too. And the question is, what are their values and what makes their values better than our values, or our values better than their values? Notice, on the one hand, the other hand. What makes their values better? What support do they have for their value system. Just what I feel, what I intuit, what I think, my experience, what is it? And if we say we believe that these values are fundamentally good and good for people, how do we defend that? I think it's important to ask what are the motives for research. And there are different kinds of motives. People sometimes do research because they want a reputation. I can think of one person I know who says, I want a Nobel Prize. And he's quite upfront. You know, that's his aim, that's his life, his research, his gear, so that he will be noticed and he will get his Nobel Prize. Some people get it because they want to make money, money for themselves or money for others. We have the intellectual property rule in Oxford. Intellectual property rule in Oxford is very simple. If I have an idea between 9 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon, the university owns the idea. If I have an idea at 5 to 9 or 5 past 5, I own the idea. So I only ever have ideas before 9 o'clock and after 5, because the intellectual property then belongs to me. Now, they introduced that because we had many science and medical researchers who have made a fortune. Made a fortune because they discovered something and they immediately patented it. And now they're millionaires. And the university said, which lab did you use to do this? When did you do all this work? Well, of course, it was a university lab. And the university was paying them to do this lab work. And so, should the university not benefit from that kind of thing? So, money can be a driving thing. Or career. Career. We were in conversation about going and speaking in different places. And people used to say to me when I was back in Oxford, why are you going to speak at this meeting? Or why are you going to that meeting? I say, well, it will look good on my resume, on my CV. And one day somebody said to me, don't you think that 25 pages is enough of a CV? Do you really need to have more? And it was a question that had never occurred to me. I'd spent so long playing this game where you had to develop your academic career, you had to speak in all different kinds of contexts, that it just became a habit. And I was doing it because it was a habit, not because it was a good thing to do or a right thing to do or was a necessary thing to do. Sometimes we do it for the sake of our career, bless you, and resume. Sometimes we do it because we're actually interested. And this is something which I think is really quite fundamental in research. That actually people want to explore. People want to understand. There's a desire that people have to make sense. If we had a blackboard, I would put up TUC and ask you what that meant, and it meant trade union movement. And then I'd write up UNESCO, United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. And then I'd write up SWALK, SWALK, sealed with a loving kiss. And because you're all such culturally experts, you'd all be able to tell me the answer. And then I'd write up TTYB. Say, what does that mean? And you would make all kinds of suggestions. And I would say, nothing. It means nothing at all. I just made it up. But what do you do? What you do is you try to make sense of it. Why? Because that's human nature. We want to understand people. We want to understand nature. We want to understand how things operate and function. There's something really deep in the nature of humanity. We want to know, what if I do this? What if that happens? So people are interested. And I think we neglect at our peril that human desire to explore. Now, it's one of the difficulties about limiting research. Sometimes people will find ways around the limits that you create. And so the desire to explore and to understand can lead to problems. But I think basically it's a good thing. I've seen, particularly in the genetics area, I have a friend who is an expert in PKU, and he was working as a pediatrician, and he suddenly realized he was beginning to see the children of patients that he'd had as children. And he thought, what is it that makes this person's child? And then he thought, I knew the grandparent. He said, why is it that PKU runs in families? And that's why they began to look for a genetic base, because he was so distressed that one generation after another was suffering, and he wanted to stop the suffering. Well, I have to understand what's causing the disease. Here's a genetic malformation, and so let's do something about that. And many people working in the areas of genetics and in the area of fertility are actually genuinely distressed about people who are infertile, people who have genetic disease. And they then want to create some kind of way forward for the benefit of other people. I'm the Arthur Holmes professor, and Art Holmes wrote particularly about truth. And he was concerned to say that all truth is God's truth, and this is God's world. And so we should try to understand God's world, and we should try to understand God's truth. And there's a desire that Christians have, and they engage in research, because they're thinking God's thoughts after him. Now I think actually, most of us are a mixture of these motives. I don't think you neatly fall into one or other categories. I think we take a little bit and we produce our own particular blend. There are a few very pure motives. We had a visit in Green College in Oxford from a lady from Mars. Not the planet, but the confectionery firm. And Mars wanted to give the college a great deal of money. And they said, we want you to give this money to set up a post in nutrition. And we have a research experiment we want you to do. And this is to ask and to answer a fundamental question. Is eating Mars bars good for you? Now, if you discover that eating Mars bars is good for you, that would be a miracle. But if you did discover that, then we want this broadcast in every scientific journal, all the press media, Mars bars are good for you. If by terrible happenstance you discover eating Mars bars is not good for you, we want that piece of research to disappear down a black hole and never be seen again. Now, to be fair to Green College and to Mars, we said, actually, that's not the way research works. And the result is the result is the result. And we can't lose it down the black hole. We're happy to explore this question, but if the results are bad, that's tough. And Mars graciously did fund the post nevertheless. I won't tell you what the result is. The person who pays the piper calls the tune. And that's the difficulty about funded research, that there's always another agenda. There's always a particular perspective that they want. And that makes the task for the scientific researcher in particular very difficult. Always you're looking over your shoulder and thinking, who funded this? And how can I present this in a way which will satisfy them as well as satisfy truth and myself and my own integrity? When Terry and I were talking about today and what we would look at, we wanted to talk about biblical perspectives, biblical patterns for teaching and for research. And I think the biblical perspective on research is really a biblical perspective, first of all, on truth. It's a belief that all truth is God's truth. And that's why I'm really puzzled why people are afraid in the Christian world of the intellect and of research. Because if we believe that the intellect is a God-given intellect, if we believe that research is going to help us understand truly how the world functions, how human nature functions, there is nothing to fear from the pursuit of truth. And so I want to encourage parents, I want to encourage pastors, I want to encourage young people to pursue truth, because all truth is God's truth. Now truth, I believe, holds together. I believe there is a coherence in truth. And if you have come up with an idea, the idea has to fit with the rest of our knowledge. It's always difficult when there are outliers in any kind of statistical pattern, because it doesn't fit our coherent kind of pattern. And so what we tend to do, and what tends to happen, is that people tend to ignore or sideline the outliers because they're looking for the broad kind of pattern. They think there must be a specific reason why this outlier is an outlier rather than fits in with the general pattern. There's a sense in which coherence is fundamental. There's a sense in which what we see, whether what we see in terms of research, what we see in terms of a mathematical formulae, what we see in terms of a chemical account, whatever the notation is, it has to picture reality. there is at the heart of science a picture theory of truth. That the language that we use, that the formula that we use, give us a picture. Poor Willie Smith, you'll see his face no more. For what he thought was H2O was really H2SO4. Now, some people think that's funny. Now, why do they think it's funny? Because they know what H2O means, and they know what H2SO4 means. But you need to understand the notation. The chemical formula matches up to a reality of water and a reality of sulfuric acid. And so if you're drinking sulfuric acid rather than water, the effects could be quite drastic. So there is a picture theory of truth. But I also think there's a pragmatic theory of truth. If you're looking philosophically, there are all kinds of theories of truth. And one important theory is the pragmatic theory. Now, Americans are very strong on pragmatism. The last four letters of American are I can. Good old Yankee know-how. That's what we need today. Pragmatism is alive and well. But pragmatism is actually very important, because pragmatism means that truth makes a difference. As I read the Bible, Old and New Testament makes no difference. God's truth makes a difference. When God enters the situation, it makes a difference. That's where truth transforms individuals and communities. Truth is transformational. And we need to recover that sense that truth is not something abstract at a distance, but is something which is central, something which is part, not only of our individual, but of our community life, and will help us make a difference. If we understand things about patterns of spread of disease, then it makes a difference to how we behave, how we enter into preventive medicine, how we enter into curative medicine, where we focus our research. Truth actually transforms. But I think biblical perspectives on truth need to be matched with biblical perspectives on human nature. Human beings were created not for their own sake. Human beings were created for God's sake. So that's why we are not our own. We're not meant to be free, autonomous individuals doing our own thing, pleasing ourselves. We're meant to live to please God. That's why the Westminster Confession, now notice, even though I'm not a Presbyterian, I still know the Westminster Confession well enough to know that the chief end of man is to enjoy God and glorify God forever. See, that commitment to God having the priority, God having his worship, his proper place. We were created for God and we were made in his image. I have two sons, they have two crosses to bear in life. One was that they used to live with me, and the other is that they look like me. Now imagine going through life looking like that. And people, of course, oh, you're David Cook's son. No, you are Simon, you are Kenneth, you're They look like me. They bear the image of their father. We bear the image of our heavenly Father. We are meant to be like God. We are meant to be like his incarnate Son. We are made in the image of God. Now, there have been endless theological tomes written about what that means. It means, I think, among other things, this is not meant to be exclusive, it means we are responsible. Now, the word responsible is an interesting word. It means we are able to give a response. Adam, where are you? Cain, where is your brother? You see, the pattern is that God comes to an individual or to a community and he calls them to give a response. That's what judgment is about. We don't hear very much about judgment nowadays. But judgment is a very important part, because it means that one day we will have to give an answer to God for all that we have said and done and not done and not said. And so what we say now, how we respond today, makes a difference, because when we respond on the day of judgment, then that response will have to be the same. It will have to be consistent. It will have to be coherent. That responsibility, that answerability is fundamental. And human beings have an awareness. I used to be on this radio program, television program, and the language that my colleagues used was rather ripe. And every now and then somebody, one of them, would swear. And then they would say, oh, sorry, David. why are you apologizing to me? Oh, because it's not a nice thing to do in front of you. Now, I never said to them, would you please stop swearing? That's not a nice thing to do in front of me. But I didn't need to say anything, because they had an awareness. God had written his law on their hearts and minds. They knew. They were able to give a response. But not only able to give a response, they were also intelligent. Intelligence makes sense of things. And I think particularly in university context, we have to recognize it's a God-given task. It's a God-given responsibility. We make sense of things, make sense of people, sense of situations, sense of nature. We're morally aware. We have that awareness of right and wrong. And that's why we can take part in the public square, because we can appeal to people's sense of right and wrong. Sharing at lunchtime that when it was announced I was coming most of the year to Wheaton, one of the Liberal MPs that I'd constantly debated, we disagreed about almost everything, he said to me, David, I'm really sorry you're going. And I said, well, why? He said, because we need to hear you. We need to hear what you've got to say. Because, then it was the really, this was the clincher, he said, because I agree with 95% of what you say. Now, I would never have known that from all the debates that we'd had and all the public disagreements and vehement disagreements. But he was actually agreeing with, not everything, but 95%. There's an awareness, a moral awareness that people have. But we also need, if we're looking at a biblical perspective on research, understanding human nature, to recognize it's communal. It's a team effort. It's not the Lone Ranger. Even the Lone Ranger needed Silver and Tonto. He needed some kind of basic community. And we need to have a community. I can tell when I was brought up, when I watched when I was a child. Hi-o, Silver! Away! I was going to give you the whole of the thing, but then I stopped myself. It was a victory of self-control there. I don't like to see people suffer too much, so I won't labour the point, except to say that research, literally on your own. Now, part of the difficulty is that I was brought up in a tradition where the idea was the scholar, particularly the monk, sitting at his desk and studying and writing on their own. And so when American students would come to Oxford and say, we're going to study together. Pardon? What does studying together look like? Studying is you on your own with your book, making sense and writing about it. But actually, even when you've read the book, and even when you've taken all the notes, and even when you've written the article, you still need to share it with people. That's why peer group review is so important in every academic discipline, because it's not a do-it-yourself activity. It's a doing it with other people. It's a doing it in the context of relationship, because we were made for relationships, made for relationship with God, with each other, and with the world. But we do not have good quality relationships. We are sinners. Now, I think that Christians don't like to say that you're a sinner. Well, they do like to say that you're a sinner. Well, they don't like to say that we are sinners. I am a sinner. Spurgeon said, you know, we should speak as one leper to other lepers, because sin is something that affects us all. It's not about the other person's problem, it's actually about my problem, it's about my nature. We are sinners, and we need to be very realistic about human nature. And I think particularly in that research world, we need to be very realistic and almost pessimistic about what human beings can do. Because we get it wrong, we mess up, we do bad things. But sin not only affects individuals, I believe it affects structures. I think there are ways in which the organizations can help or hinder human growth, human flourishing, human well-being. And we need to look very hard at some of our structures in the church, whether or not the church structure is really serving the good of people, or it's actually restricting, diminishing people in messy, sinful kinds of ways. Look at communities. Now, I think that if you're looking for a text for this, Romans 13 gives us that. Why do we have governments? That's a good question, I think. Why do we have governments? Because the government is there to restrain evil and to reinforce what's good. And so part of our Christian God-given responsibility is to help restrain what's evil and help reinforce what's good. That's how we ought to be living in a world which has fallen. But the good news is, in Christ there is newness of life. In Christ we're given grace and power of the Holy Spirit. In Christ we are part of a community, the church, a community which is mutually answerable, a place where there is a sense of vocation. When people present and say, I feel I'm called to ministry, I say, what does your church say? Because just because you feel God has called you to ministry doesn't mean that you are called to ministry. I'm looking for the church, for the people of God to affirm, yes, we believe. And sometimes, you know, the people of God say, you are called to ministry. You know, no, I'm not. No, we believe as a community that you're called. And so I think the community is a very important role, not just in the church, but in research. A sense of vocation. What is that calling? A sense of prayer. I think that when I'm broadcasting, I have friends that I tell what time I'll be broadcasting, what the theme is, and they pray for me. And sometimes when I'm sitting there in a studio and my mind is totally blank, I cannot think of anything to say. And then the awful happens. The presenter says, well, nobody seems to have very much to say, but we know that David Cook always has something to say. So come on, David. This is live programs. And so you're thinking, God, help me. And God does. God gives you the word. Now, sometimes I don't hear it properly, so I don't always come out the right way. But I believe that God does give us. I believe that Jesus has promised that when you appear before principalities, powers, before authority, then God himself will give us that word. But we also need personal and professional support. It's interesting in college life, and I'm talking now again about my experiences in Oxford. I have one friend who works in the social work department, and I say to her, you know, hello, how are you? And she says, do you have half an hour? And I'll tell you. Because if you haven't got half an hour, I'm not going to tell you. Now that's always, to me, a great corrective. Because you get into habit, hello, how are you? And it doesn't mean, how are you? It means, hello. But if I'm going to say, hello, how are you? Then let's sit down. Let's talk about this. Let's take it seriously. My office in Oxford, I'd go in the morning and say, look, I've got to prepare this, so unless it's suicidal, don't talk to me for an hour. Because I hadn't got the time. Sometimes you have to be left alone to do the work. But if that's how you live all the time, there's something wrong with you and something wrong with our understanding of community, of team, because we work as a team. I couldn't have done half the things, quarter of the things that I did in the UK without a team. People who did the research, people who typed it up, people who made all the arrangements. I used to have a researcher, and he would drive me places. And we would go somewhere, and often, you know, there'd be a meal. So there'd be 100, 200, however many people at the meal. And, you know, they'd say, well, this is your seat. And he would sit down beside me. I said, Lee, you don't have to sit with me. You can go and sit, you know, meet somebody interesting. He says, no, if I sit beside you, you don't have to talk to me. That's one less person for you to talk to. He was so careful of my time and my energy, he wanted to protect you. Now, he'd learned that from a politician. He worked for a politician. The politician said, you always sit there so that I only have one person to worry about rather than two. And he translated that into a service mentality, because we all need professional support. He'd come to me, you know, after a meeting, we'd have a cup of tea. Always the Brits have to have a cup of tea, you know, stirred, not shaken. And so I was having my cup of tea, and he'd come up and say, David, I think we have to go now. You have an urgent thing to see to. So I get in the car and say, what's this urgent thing? Oh, no. You just needed to go. Again, that desire to support you, the desire to make sure you were not pressurized in the wrong kind of way. Research, I believe, is a vocation from God. And that's why we are lucky people. We are fortunate, blessed people, because we have the privilege of actually doing research, actually fulfilling the calling that God has given us. And the calling from God, I think, calls and empowers. Here's a guy who's got a withered right hand. And Jesus says to him, stretch out your hand. And he does. There's a man who's been lying beside the pool for 35 years and never been able to get up and into the pool in time. And Jesus says, get up, take up your bed, and walk. And he does. Because when Jesus calls us, he empowers us. He gives us the capacity to fulfill the call, the calling. He doesn't call unless he gives us that power. I think it's also exciting to think God's thoughts after him. And that should lead us to a sense of worship. I have a number of friends who are interested in the physics and quantum physics and that kind of world, which I don't pretend to understand. But when they talk to each other, when I listen in, you get a sense of excitement. A sense of their excitement, because they think, isn't this incredible? God has made this absolutely amazing world, and it operates in this amazing kind of way. And if only poor David could understand it, then he would really appreciate how good God is and how clever God is. It leads to a sense of worship. But proper research, I think, also makes a difference to the world and people. John Stott, he once a year, with myself and one other person, we would run beginning research. People who were just beginning to undertake MPhils, PhDs, we'd get them for a week in Oxford, and John would graciously come up. And he always gave the same talk. But the same talk was important because, of course, for these people, it was the first time they heard it. And he would say to them, you must not be a tadpole. A tadpole has a huge head and not very much body. And the trouble with researchers is we can end up with huge heads and not much else to us. And that's a flawed understanding. Knowledge is about action. Knowledge is about transforming. Knowledge is about making a difference to the world and to people. But research has to be done in fellowship. It's interesting in Oxford that they call you a fellow of the college. And I'm a member of the fellowship. Isn't it interesting that when secular organizations want to express what is the proper way of relating, they use religious language. The fellowship, the koinonia, that community of people who live and work and care together. Research is done in fellowship, and that's with colleagues. It's done in a university context. It's done in a firm context, business, or it's done in a church kind of context. I want to thank you for inviting me. I want to thank you for giving up a Saturday to come and to share together, because I hope that we have shared together rather than just had the semi-stage on the semi-stage probably. I want to stand together. I want to express to you my excitement for you and for me that we have been called to do this amazing task. I often think, you know, I am paid to do what I would do for nothing, because it's so fulfilling and satisfying, and it can make a difference to people. When I meet students now, you know, grown up, balding, and that's only the women, they say to me, well, somebody said to me the other day, I once heard you say, I didn't remember saying that, but they did, and it made a difference to them, and not just Christian people. I had an email the other day from a young lady who was studying medicine, and she said, I heard you speak about medical ethics, and that made me go into medicine. And so we can have an effect on people. We can have effect in teaching, but we can have a greater effect in research. When I teach, I affect one person. That's what the tutorial method does. But when I do research and produce books or whatever, then lots of people can read it. You can even go on MP3 player and download David Cook. Not the singing variety, but the talking one. I want to encourage you, as Christian people, to make the very most of every opportunity you have. I believe that we have a responsibility not just to do the research, but the way in which we do the research. And the way that we work in teams, in universities, in commercial firms, we can make a difference. We can transform society. We can restrain evil. We can reinforce what's good. But we do it not on our own, and not even together. We do it because God, in His goodness, has given us the power and the grace of the Holy Spirit, who not only leads us into all truth, but enables us, empowers us, gives us His grace so that we can be like Christ. Thank you all very much.